Just imagine it. You're watching the sunset from your Miami Beach condo. You're on top of the world, or at least it seems so from this vantage point. What's the difference? A large cross-section of the world population knows your face, name, songs, relationships, missteps, and sexual misadventures. It's peaceful, though. You can breathe here. Here you can be the soft-spoken, poetic type that likes walks in the park, eating Cheetos, and watching Law & Order reruns. Out there, you're the center of the universe. You can't walk to Carbone without your picture being taken and groups of people flocking to you like you're the walking, talking, gold-plated messiah that parties like a god and fucks with the same gravitas. Every party, every after-party, and after-after-party you've been scheduled to show up to. You are met with flashbulbs and your name being screamed at you by fans desperate for your attention and acknowledgement. Desperate just to be seen. Well, isn't that why you started playing music? To be seen? To be acknowledged? To make millions of fucking dollars doing what you love? Take a big long whiff, my friend. This is the life you chose, and it'll be the life you live from here on out, be it because of ego, or a contractually mandated solidarity with three schmucks you saddled yourself with for the past three albums and next four albums. After playing your first gig at 17, the rockstar lifestyle looked so tempting. Everyone you see on MTV with the fame, the money, the notoriety, that someone was hired to report on the fact they took a shit this morning. The glamour. 10 years later, this is what it looks like. Alone, addicted, still rich, but not for long. People come, people go. Couldn't care less about them when they show up, but you're the first one to spring off the couch to stop them from leaving. Have another bump, have another drink. Have you guys ever seen my gold record room? But they always end up leaving. Not that you're at the door to see the hangers-ons out. If you're not swimming in your own puke on your $30,000 Persian rug, then you're drooling and mumbling on your $10,000 Italian silk sofa. Things used to be so simple. Do you remember when they were simple? Like that one time years ago when you woke up around 11, walked over to the park, then rented RoboCop for the 10th time for Blockbuster and the world around you didn't stop and take notice? Yeah, I didn't think so. But it did happen. It's been 4 years since you signed on the line for a real good time and cut your first record. It's been uphill and downhill from that day on. From blowjobs, filet mignon, and Lamborghini collections, to four-day whiskey and coke benders in some flop house on the outskirts of town. You're really burning the proverbial candle at both ends, huh? It's okay. Get help now. You're not going to be a one-hit wonder, you'll be a, five-hit wonder. Exit stage left, asshole. If you're not happy with the way things turned out, leave. Hit the fucking trail. It's not like you don't have the money to live comfortably for the rest of your life. Oh, yeah, I guess there's that record contract you would have killed your family and best friend to get. Look at the bright side. Those talentless drips you were saddled with will be eager to make a paycheck. Maybe this go-around they'll earn it on your name and make you an even bigger fucking star. You gotta get out of this. Seriously. If you stop today, you did better than 98% of the population and light years better than the expectations you had graduating high school. Just quit. Go to rehab. Read some Kerouac. Go meet a girl who's a nurse. Buy a house in the country. Drink a Coors Light and take in the scenery. It'll be good for the soul. You'll be okay. That doesn't fit into your plan though, does it? The plan you had for world domination. In your whiskey and coke hazes, you saw yourself on a mountaintop. Your name, your music, your very essence controlling, guiding, and manipulating the zeitgeist of the world. Your music, your likeness, you. Millions will clamor, thousands will rush towards you just to be in your sphere. Hundreds will do what you say when you say it, A handful will still give you a briefcase full of cash for the next great single in spite of the last flop, and one will be there. Smack. Doesn't that make you feel best of all? A little whiskey to bring you down? And then hop on the horse to bring you to your land of make-believe where none of this exists. A place where contract disputes, bad crowds, TMZ, and the pain life brings day after day doesn't exist. Sun is almost over the horizon. You should get dressed. It's not like you don't have the swankiest shit to wear. Head on down to the garage. Pick one of the 5 fucking Lamborghinis you have to choose from. Pick the green one. That was always your favorite. You got 4 models and 2 regulars on the phone. Call one. Anyone. Your standing reservation at Carbone is never ending. Do something other than what you're doing. Or don't. Oh great, the smack's here. Never mind. I guess we're staying in tonight. Look at that sunset though. It's beautiful. It's kind of poetic, isn't it? At an age where you should be captain of industry, a role model, someone for the youth to look up to, the next Mick goddamn fucking Jagger. But no, you've gone far enough. You did what you had to do. Until album number 4 needs to be written, recorded, mixed, produced, pressed, released, and supported. Sounds like hell, huh? It does, but you'll be living your dream. Making money, singing your songs, seeing places most people never see, doing things most people never do. Simply by being you. Huh. Still not enough, is it? You can't just be successful with a handful of hit singles and retire, can you? Whatever. The sun is set. All the buildings around have their lights on. You're gonna get fucked up tonight, aren't you? Well, maybe we'll hit Carbone tomorrow. The record company and band can wait another day, right?
Oh. I'll see myself out. I'll talk to you tomorrow. Don't forget what I said, though. I hear New Hampshire's really nice this time of year.
We'll do it live! Fuck it!
Good evening and welcome to the Cosmic Highway Patrol, coming at you from the outskirts of Brevard County, Florida, USA. I am your host, Matt Chouinard. Thank you for joining me. So right up top, had to skip another week, but I'm going to try to get back to the weekly schedule. I'd like to thank everyone who hit the follow button on Spotify and Amazon and Insta. If you have subject suggestions, questions, comments, thoughts, feelings, let me know at cosmichighwaypatrol@gmail.com or cosmichighwaypatrol on Instagram. I think that's about it for the housekeeping, so let's get into it. So what is the 27 Club? Over the years, going back to the 30s and even before that, there have been a large number of musicians in particular that have met their untimely demise at the ripe old age of 27. And though the causes of death seem to vary when you look at the list as a whole, drug and alcohol abuse leading to overdoses tops the list without question. I am going to be splitting this subject into 2 parts, with part 2 coming out sometime in the next couple months. In that episode, I'll be covering Kurt Cobain, Kristen Pfaff, Amy Winehouse, Mia Zapata, and Pete DeFreitas. Tonight we'll be covering Brian Jones, Jimi Hendrix, Janis Joplin, and Jim Morrison, which is to say 1969 to 1971, to the day. All in the window of exactly 2 years to the day, July 3rd, 1969 to July 3rd, 1971. It's pretty crazy when you think about it. They were all at the top of their game in the mid-60s, or at least on their way, and oftentimes were in each other's orbit in some form or fashion. I know I was looking at some pictures of Jimi Hendrix and Janis Joplin backstage. I guess they used to hang out quite a bit whenever they passed through on their various tours. At least three of the four played the biggest shows of the time period. Three of the four were at the Monterey Pop Festival from June 16th to June 18th, 1967. Though the Rolling Stones didn't play that one, Brian Jones was there to introduce Jimi Hendrix's Experience. Janis and Big Brother played the previous afternoon, as did fellow 27 Club member Alan Blind Owl Wilson, member of Canned Heat, the one who sang Going Up Country and On the Road Again. Janis and Jimmy were at Woodstock with Alan Wilson. The Doors canceled their appearance, thinking it was just going to be another rip-off of the Monterey Pop Festival. Then ultimately they regretted it. I can see why. I guess the point is they all ran in the same circles and at some point crossed paths, either on the road, sharing billings at festivals and tours, or even having the same friends. Either way, they were all acquainted, more Jimmy, Jim, and Janis. I think what gets me more than anything is just how fast everything happened for all of them. Everything you've ever heard recorded from them was recorded in the span of about 5 years. Generations of musicians have been heavily influenced by Jimmy, Jim, Janis, and Brian of the Jimi Hendrix Experience, The Doors, Janis Joplin with Big Brother and Holding Company, and of course, the Rolling Stones. Every Rolling Stones track that makes you think of Vietnam War footage, riots, protests, and the overall vibe of the 1960s counterculture, Brian Jones was there. Louis Brian Hopkin Jones was born February 28, 1942 in Cheltenham, Gloucestershire, England, to Louis and Louisa Jones, both of Welsh descent. Interesting note, Brian's father was an aeronautical engineer, along with being a piano teacher, and his mother played organ at church. Brian's early musical influences skewed primarily to the blues by Elmore James and fellow 27 Club member Robert Johnson. At the age of 17, he got his first guitar. It was at this time that he started playing local pubs and clubs, along with making a couple quid playing as a street performer. In his late teens, he lived a somewhat carefree lifestyle. So carefree, in fact, by age 19, he had three kids. I mean, he wasn't taking care of them or anything. You know, very carefree. He was having them, though. Anyway, I've never lived a bohemian lifestyle, but I guess birth control and overall responsibility don't jive in those circles. He had a fourth kid by age 22 with a street performer income. In May of 1962, he put out an ad for an R&B group and found two guys named Mick Jagger and Keith Richards, and soon they began playing Chuck Berry tunes. For a year, Brian, Keith, and Mick were roommates at a Chelsea flat from 1962 to 1963. It was during this time that Bill Wyman and Charlie Watts were added to the Rolling Stones roster on bass and drums, respectively. Brian Jones was quite the talented multi-instrumentalist, playing guitar, drums, piano, organ, sax, and harmonica, just to name a few. The guy could play pretty much anything. He also played the sitar. You can hear him on Paint It Black and Street Fighting Man. And you can hear him sing backup on Sympathy for the Devil, harmonica on Who's Driving Your Plane, and mellotron on 2,000 Light Years from Home. The guy played just about every instrument you can possibly think of on at least one of the Rolling Stones' early recordings. There were many factors that started to drive a wedge between Brian and the rest of the band that he founded. In 1966, he broke his hand punching his girlfriend in the face. She ended up leaving him for the somehow immortal Keith Richards. If losing the girl he clearly didn't care about to a bandmate wasn't enough, new management and overall popularity of the Jagger-Richards duo were starting to lower Jones's songwriting stock in the band bit by bit, and with that he was being pushed out of the writing process of the band that, once again, he founded. It was around 1967 when his girlfriend Anita Pallenberg left him and his drug and alcohol abuse ramped up, missing recording sessions, and band obligations. By 1968, Jones wasn't included in the writing process due to tensions with the rest of the band because of substance abuse and overall erratic behavior, where once he played multiple instruments on a track, now is backing vocals, rhythm guitar, or occasional exotic instrument. The last album Jones worked on with the Stones was 1968's Beggar's Banquet. By the time Let It Bleed was being recorded, he seemed to be completely unable to write, record, or perform. Throughout the early part of 1969, when Jones showed up to record, he rarely could, if at all, contribute to the writing process. When Let It Bleed was scheduled to release in July of 1969, the Rolling Stones were putting together a tour of North America starting in November. This, however, was impossible for Jones, as he was unable to receive a work permit due to his previous drug convictions. Soon thereafter, the Rolling Stones replaced him with Blues Breakers guitarist Mick Taylor. At this time, Jones was looking to put together another band while living in Crotchford Farms in East Sussex. Names that include the Animals keyboard player Alan Price, Jimi Hendrix experienced drummer Mitch Mitchell, and inexplicably, John Lennon. At about midnight on July 2nd to 3rd, 1969, Brian Jones was found at the bottom of a swimming pool, motionless. He was pronounced dead on arrival at the hospital. Official cause of death was ruled as death by misadventure, which in the UK pretty much means you died by doing something dangerous and avoidable. The coroner later noted an enlarged heart and liver from substance abuse. Both Jimi Hendrix and Jim Morrison dedicated works in his honor. Jones was buried 3 meters deep, or about 10 feet, at Cheltenham Cemetery in order to thwart attempts of grave robbing. Just imagine if he got himself straightened out, got back to it, forming another band. He formed the Rolling Stones. Who's to say he couldn't have done it again with Alan Price, Mitch Mitchell, and John Lennon? Maybe even sharing a bill with the Band of Gypsies or Full Tilt Boogie Band. Both only had a little while left before losing their star power. My introduction to Jimi Hendrix was the Band of Gypsies album recorded on New Year's Day in 1970. The first track, Who Knows, is an absolute jam from the first note, followed by Machine Gun, which I gotta say, it's my favorite off the album, that bass line. But it's Jimmy's guitar and lyrics which got everyone's attention. James Marshall Hendrix, born Johnny Allen Hendrix, was born November 27, 1942 to Al and Lucille Hendrix in Seattle, Washington. When Jimmy was about 4, his name was changed to James Marshall Hendrix to honor his late uncle. It's kind of ironic that years later he'd be seen and heard countless times in front of a wall of Marshall full stacks. In fact, Jim Marshall of Marshall Amplification once said Hendrix was the greatest ambassador for the amplifiers, having bought as many as 100 in a 4-year period. His father, Al, was in the Army and stationed in Alabama when Jimmy was born. It wasn't until Al was honorably discharged in September of 1945 that he saw his son for the first time. Soon after, he reconciled with Lucille and tried to make things work. Unfortunately for everyone, they often fought while drunk. This didn't lead to a steady home life. In December of 1951, Jimmy's parents divorced and his youngest 3 siblings were sent to foster care or adoption. Jimmy and his brother Leon went on to live with Al. In 1958, his mother Lucille died of a ruptured spleen along with having cirrhosis of the liver. A couple months later, the 15-year-old got his first guitar for $5 whole. You can only speculate what that guitar would be worth today and in what museum it would be in. He was heavily influenced by the blues mainstays of the day, kind of like Howlin' Wolf, Muddy Waters, B.B. King, along with fellow club member Robert Johnson. The first song young James Marshall learned was the Peter Gunn theme. Not long after this, Jimmy formed his first band, the Velvetones. It seems like if you started or fronted a group from the late 50s into the early 60s, just put the suffix tones at the end of the name, or put the in the beginning, and make it plural, and voila, you have a band name. A much simpler time indeed. At about the age of 18, he was caught for the second time joyriding in stolen cars. The judge gave him the choice of either going to jail or going into the Army. He chose the Army. In 1961, after finishing up basic training, he was sent to Fort Campbell with the 101st Airborne. It was at Fort Campbell that he met future Band of Gypsies bandmate, Billy Cox. In 1962, he received a general discharge after serving just 13 months in the Army due to poor conduct and just being an overall poor soldier. Once out of the Army, Jimmy was stone free to do what he pleased. Between 62 and 66, he backed up Wilson Pickett, Little Richard, the Isley Brothers, and Ike and Tina Turner, just to name a few. While playing with his band Jimmy James and the Blue Flames in 1966 in Manhattan, he became friends with Linda Keith. Keith Richards' girlfriend at the time saw Jimmy and absolutely loved the performance. After referring him to Keith Richards, he found his way to the London scene, where soon he recorded Hey Joe and Stone Free with Noel Redding and Mitch Mitchell in late 1966. From late 1966 to late 1967, Hendrix and The Experience recorded Are You Experienced, Axis, Bold as Love, and Electric Ladyland. In about the same time he spent in the Army, he recorded every Jimi Hendrix song we know. Well, almost. The Experience began to crumble in January 1969, playing their last performance in Denver on June 5, 1969. It was his performance at Woodstock on August 1969 that solidified his rock god status. After being up for 3 days straight, he took the stage at 8 a.m. on Monday morning. It was when he played the Star Spangled Banner, the way he played it. He tapped into what everyone was feeling and thinking at the time, and it became one of the most iconic clips in rock history. Soon after the performance, he collapsed from exhaustion. Hendrix would continue through the rest of 69 and into 70 playing with Billy Cox and Buddy Miles as the Band of Gypsies. Unfortunately, throughout 1970, Hendrix had a series of less than stellar performances, walking off stage for one show and being booed off stage for another. His last concert was on September 6, 1970 in West Germany. On the morning of September 18, 1970, Hendrix was found breathing but unresponsive and was pronounced dead at 12:45 p.m. It was found that Hendrix died from asphyxia while on barbiturates, basically being suffocated by his own vomit. Across the pond about this time, fellow Woodstock performer and future Rock and Roll Hall of Fame member Janis Joplin was having struggles of her own. Born Janis Lynn Joplin on January 19, 1943 in Port Arthur, Texas, to Seth and Dorothy Joplin. She became interested in blues music in her teenage years, a time when she was shunned by most of her classmates for being overweight and acne-scarred. She graduated from the Jefferson High School in 1960 with Texas football coaching legend Jimmy Johnson. Soon after, she found herself at the University of Texas. Not feeling the vibes of college life, in 1963, she hitchhiked her way to San Francisco with her friend Chet Helms, who later became a bit of a subculture mainstay himself. In the time between moving to San Francisco and recording, she was arrested for shoplifting and became a regular user of heroin. In 1964, Joplin and future Jefferson Airplane guitarist Jorma Kaukonen recorded several tracks with Jorma's girlfriend in the background on a typewriter. These recordings were my introduction to Janis Joplin. I borrowed the CD with these recordings on them sometime in the early 2000s. I swear I left the repeat button on the track Trouble in Mind going for a solid week. I never got why there was a typewriter going in the background, but whatever. Of all her hits, that one track still hits even today. But after almost 3 years in San Francisco, she moved back to Port Arthur, chewed up and spit out, at least seemingly. When she got home, she was emaciated, weighing just 88 pounds. It was at this point she changed her everyday habits, swore off drugs of any kind, and got engaged to a guy from New York that she met in San Francisco who worked on IBM computers. Fortunately or unfortunately, depending on how you look at it, this engagement didn't last. In 1966, she was recruited by her hitchhiking friend Chet Helms to try out for the front woman for the band that he was managing. Big Brother and Holding Company. Spoiler alert, she got the part, and she joined up on June 4, 1966. A year later, Joplin and Big Brother played the historic Monterey Pop Festival, which was the first large-scale performance for her, The Who, and Jimi Hendrix. 1968 was a big year for Joplin. In February, they kicked off their first tour along with making the first television appearance on The Morning, hosted by Dick Cavett. After recording Peace of My Heart and Summertime for the album Cheap Thrills, Joplin left Big Brother in December of 68 to form her own band, the Cosmic Blues Band, in early 1969. It was about this time, when adjusted for inflation, Joplin was using $1,600 a day of heroin. The first album by Cosmic Blues Band went gold, but in spite of everything received mixed reviews amongst critics. In August 1969, Joplin and crew played at Woodstock at 2 a.m. on August 17th, though she arrived via helicopter around 4 the previous afternoon, which gave her ample time to drink and shoot up. By the time she made it to the stage, she wasn't as electrifying as she was known to be. Even still, it was said she put on a captivating performance. During a vacation to Brazil in February of 1970, Janis met an American. This particular trip was made in hopes to help her kick the habit. Once back in the States, the romance crumbled when he saw her shooting heroin. It was about this time she formed another band, one that was truly hers, a band she called Main Squeeze. After what I can only imagine were a slew of lewd comments from Hell's Angels she was associated with, she soon changed the name to the Full Tilt Boogie Band. By the spring of 1970 on tour, she claimed to be drug-free, though it was evident she still drank heavily. Janis Joplin's last performance was at Harvard Stadium in Boston, Massachusetts. The spark that lit the fuse for her demise happened on August 14, 1970, when she attended her high school reunion. In hopes of showing up triumphant, a multi-gold record holder, the face of the era's feminist can-do spirit only brought on bad memories of the past, those who made fun of her, and the reason she left in the first place. Throughout August, September, and into October, Joplin and the band were recording their album, Pearl. This one includes Me and Bobby McGee and Mercedes-Benz. Mercedes-Benz was recorded in one take on October 1st, 1970. On October 4th, she was found on the floor dead in her hotel room from a heroin overdose made worse by alcohol. Across the country in the great state of Florida, Doors frontman Jim Morrison was awaiting sentencing for indecent exposure charges, amongst others, presumably trying to start a riot at the Dinner Key Auditorium in Miami on March 1, 1969. James Douglas Morrison was born on December 8, 1943, to then naval aviator and future admiral in the Gulf of Tonkin, George Stephen Morrison, and his wife Clara, in Melbourne, Florida. I used to pass by his birthplace every day on my way to work. They have a sign out in the front and everything. He spent his childhood as an army brat, living in California, Virginia, Texas, New Mexico, back to California, then finally graduating from George Washington High School in Alexandria, Virginia in 1961. He was a very bright student with an average grade of 88% and an IQ of 149, which, if I'm not mistaken, that's genius level. He was a voracious reader of poetry and philosophy from writers like William S. Burroughs, Allen Ginsberg, Jack Kerouac, amongst many, many others. He was doing book reports on books, subjects, and writers that teachers didn't even know existed. After high school, he went to junior college in St. Petersburg, Florida, before transferring to FSU in 1962. He then transferred to UCLA to study film and theater. It was there that he met fellow cinematography student and soon-to-be bandmate Ray Manzarek. Soon after, John Densmore and Robbie Krieger joined the roster to call themselves The Doors. In August of 1966, The Doors began recording their self-titled album after honing their skills as the house band for the Whiskey A Go-Go for several months prior. They were initially signed to Columbia Records, but soon signed to Elektra after being seen at the Whiskey by the label's president. Several days after this meeting, The Doors were fired as the house band due to Morrison's improvised profanity-laced poem about Oedipus while playing The End. In the summer of 1967, The Doors shot up in popularity, spending 3 weeks on the Billboard Hot 100 with the single Light My Fire. On September 17, 1967, The Doors appeared on The Ed Sullivan Show. Ed Sullivan wanted them to go and play People Are Strange and Light My Fire. The show's censors took umbrage to the lyric, Girl, We Couldn't Get Much Higher, and insisted it be changed to Girl, We Couldn't Get Much Better. After reluctantly agreeing to go forward with the change, The Doors proceeded to play the song in its entirety, completely unchanged. Needless to say, an incensed Ed Sullivan banned them from the show, and The Doors moved on to bigger and better things. I mean, we probably wouldn't be talking about Ed Sullivan if it wasn't for Elvis's gyrations and Morrison's staring in the camera, spitting in the face of the censors. I love it. 3 months later, Morrison was arrested on stage, mainly for taunting the police who maced him backstage after he was caught in the shower with a female fan. On March 1, 1969, Morrison attempted to start a riot by shouting obscenities, which led to 6 warrants out for his arrest. And on September 20, 1970, he was convicted of indecent exposure and profanity after a 16-day trial. On October 30th, he was sentenced to 6 months in prison and a whopping $500 fine. Morrison was free on a $50,000 bond, which kept him from ever doing any of that time. The same month, the Doors regrouped and recorded Morrison's last album, L.A. Woman. Once finished, Morrison left for Paris in March of 1971 to be with his girlfriend, Pamela Corson. On July 3, 1971, he was found dead in the bathtub by Pamela at 6 a.m. Though the official cause was ruled as heart failure, no autopsy was done. There are several people who insist it was a heroin overdose, but with no autopsy, it'll never be known for sure. Morrison is buried at Père Lachaise Cemetery in Paris. Morrison's gravestone has been vandalized over the years and now has a bronze plaque on a flat stone with the Greek inscription that translates to, "True to his own spirit." This is the end. So that's Four Dead at 27, starting on July 3rd, 1969 and ending 2 years to the day later. They all had something or several things in common besides their age. They all seemed to have died during the first slump in their career after a meteoric rise to fame. They all, at least presumably, died of drug overdoses, and they all lived about 5 years after their first record came out. They are also all Hall of Fame inductees. And of course, being the car guy that I am, I found they all had cool cars. Well, at least 75% of them did anyway. Janis had a wildly painted 64 Porsche Cabriolet. Jim Morrison's one and only car was a 67 Shelby GT500. And Jimmy had a slick-looking 69 Vette. And Jonesy, well, by all accounts, he just rode around in the back of the Rolling Stones Jaguar. I read about Jim Shelby. Apparently, he was inspired by his hairdresser's GT350. His hairstylist was none other than Jay Sebring, one of the victims of the Manson family murders. It's crazy, the 6 degrees of separation. Anyway, there are currently 54 members of the 27 Club, some of which you may know, others you'd have to be a fan of the band to know, like Alan Blind Owl Wilson from Canned Heat, as mentioned earlier, in 1970, or Ron Pigpen McKernan from The Grateful Dead, who died in 73 from a gastrointestinal hemorrhage. Ugh. And the one I can't seem to wrap my head around being Leslie Harvey, a guitarist for the Scottish rock band Stone the Crows. Harvey was electrocuted on stage during a performance when he grabbed the mic that wasn't grounded while touching the strings of his guitar. And though not a musician, I think it's worthy of mention that Pamela Corson, Jim Morrison's girlfriend and the one who discovered him in the bathtub, also died at 27, 2 years after he did. So there you have it. That's the 27 Club. This was a pretty big subject, and I'm going to be doing a part two sometime soon. Believe me, I haven't forgotten about Kurt, Amy, Robert, Kristen, and Mia. So what do you think about all this? Let me know at Cosmic Highway Patrol on Instagram or cosmichighwaypatrol@gmail.com. Thank you once again to everyone who hit the follow button on Spotify and Instagram. I think that just about does it for me. Taillights and tire smoke, I'm out of here. Good night and take care.